This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A series of loud explosions are heard in Kiev on the second day of the Russian military operation against Ukraine. Ukraine's president says he is not afraid of talking about neutrality as his request for joining NATO has remained unanswered. Plus, Iran's president tells his Russian counterpart that NATO's eastward expansion is a serious threat to the stability and security of independent countries. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. A series of loud explosions have been heard in Kiev as the Russian military operation against Ukraine enters its second day. The Ukrainian official says the explosions were caused after the country's air defenses fired at an aircraft that was downed. The official says the aircraft crashed into a residential building and set it on fire. In the west, missiles hit an airport in the city of Rivne, while sirens went off in Lviv. To the south, explosions were also heard in Odessa. And eastward, a missile strike hit a border post, killing and injuring a number of guards. Ukraine's president says Russia resumed its missile attacks at 4 a.m. local time. Volodymyr Zelensky has also spoken of sabotage groups entering the capital.
There's also information that enemy sabotage groups have entered Kiev. So I ask the people of Kiev, be careful, respect the curfew rules. I'm staying in the government's quarter together with all those who are needed for the central government to work.
Zelensky says the Russian advance has been stopped in most directions. He complains that his country has been left alone by the world and that sanctions are not enough to stop Russia. Earlier, he said he is not afraid of talking about neutrality, as his request for joining NATO has remained unanswered. The Ukrainian president says the Western military alliance is afraid of accepting his country. Over 100 Ukrainians have been killed since Russia began its attack on Thursday. Kiev says it has killed dozens of Russian and pro-Russian troops. In the meantime, Moscow says it controls Ukraine's skies and has spoken of readiness to negotiate terms of surrender. Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist and political commentator, is on the line from Irkutsk. Dmitry, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Let me first ask you to express your own opinion about the conflict that is going on in Ukraine and the causes of this conflict.
Well, the news have been so swift that they overwhelmed even me. I expected something like that, but it means that Vladimir Putin received some information of such huge significance that he took the decision to act swiftly like this. That means that that might be the danger of Ukrainian offense against Luhansk and Donetsk, the newly recognized republics, or maybe even some more serious moves from Ukraine's Western partners. And I think that Vladimir Putin have calculated everything while comparing what Russia loses and what Russia gets if Russia acts like this.
I want you to tell us a little bit more about the Minsk agreements, because Russia says what Ukraine has been doing with regards to the Donbass region, the Donetsk and the Luhansk republics, constituted some crimes and has been in violation of the Minsk agreements. Is he right in saying that?
Well, Ukraine didn't recognize Minsk agreements from the very beginning. It didn't hold on to them. So what was Ukraine doing for all years since was violating them, was shelling Luhansk and Donetsk neighborhoods, killing civilians, and the shelling didn't stop for a day. So there's nothing to say anymore. There was no Minsk agreements for Ukraine. It didn't hold on to them, absolutely.
Okay. China says it understands Russia's security concerns. Can you tell us what kind of a role can the position that China takes here plays in the equation?
Well, right now, China just agrees more or less with the position of Vladimir Putin in Russia. China stays away of being directly involved into this. But I think should anything serious happen, China will stand with Russia. That's what I think. For now, China just says it agrees with most of Vladimir Putin's points.
How long do you think it will take for Russia to fully capture Kiev? And can this conflict spill over?
Well, the thing is whether Russia wants to take over Kyiv or not. Russia says it wants demilitarize and denazize Ukraine, which means Russia already took control over Ukrainian sky. It destroyed 12, maybe more now, airports in Ukraine, which makes impossible to send aviation against Luhansk, Donetsk, or anybody else. Russia destroyed the rocket launching complex. Russia destroyed the radio reconnaissance complexes. So Russia took over almost all territory of Ukraine. I mean, destroying the objects of military infrastructure. Russia neutralized an airport near Kyiv. So I don't know if Russians gonna enter Kyiv because Russian troops have direct orders not to enter the cities. And the lines from the Ukrainian side is overwhelming. They say they took back a few cities which were taken by Russians. Nothing like that happened. I called Mariupol, where I have relatives and friends, and they said nobody took over Mariupol and nobody took it back. Everything was very calm in Mariupol. The cannonade was heard by them from the outskirts of Mariupol, where the airport was blocked by Russian forces. Nothing like that. So I think Russia wants to block Ukrainian army forces and force Ukraine to surrender. I mean, force Ukraine to come to peace talks and discuss the neutral status of Ukraine. But I think it's rather than Zelensky loses control, he already lost control over Ukraine, and I think Zelensky might be considering fleeing out of Ukraine. And you know, it's the matter of hours when Ukraine may lose control over the gas transit system. Guess who's going to take control over it? And guess what answer to the European and the United States sanctions might be from those forces who took control over gas transit system? I think Vladimir Putin calculated everything, and he knows what he's doing, whether we like it or not. He's a very strong politician. And in the United States, they say we have to take Vladimir Putin's point about NATO, about Ukraine. But it's too late now. I think we have to relax and watch what is going on. The thing is that no civilians died from the Russian actions in Ukraine now. A lot of civilians already died in Luhansk and Donetsk. I think 12 civilians died of shelling from the Ukrainian side. It doesn't matter how many troops have died already. It's a, well, a war operation, military operation, which means that some militaries can die. But I think that what Russian media says, mostly true, comparing to Ukrainian, which lies constantly about down in numbers of Russian helicopters and fighter jets and burning up Russian tanks and capturing tens of Russian troops. Those are lies. Maybe there is a small number of Russian troops who died. I don't know. I didn't see reports. But the, well, like I said.
Many, many thanks, Dmitry. Thank you for the input. I appreciate it. I've been talking to Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist and political commentator who joined us from Irkutsk. Moving on, the European Union imposes what it calls the harshest package of sanctions against Russia over its military actions in Ukraine.
We're now targeting 7% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense. And these sanctions will increase Russia's borrowing costs, raise inflation, and gradually erode Russia's industrial base.
Von der Leyen made the comments in a press conference after an emergency meeting with European leaders. During the presser, French President Emmanuel Macron said the Russian attack on Ukraine shows Europe needs to become a real power and be independent in the fields of energy and security. Some Western countries are also taking punitive measures against Russia over its attack on Ukraine. The United States announced a wave of new sanctions on Moscow, targeting 5 major Russian banks. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced sanctions against some 60 individuals and entities. Australia and the UK have also taken similar measures. Investigative journalist and political commentator Tony Gosling says imposing sanctions is all the US and the UK can do to Russia, and they will never succeed in pushing Moscow out of the global economy.
Well, we had several hours of discussion and debate in the British Houses of Parliament at the beginning of the week about sanctions, even though this had never happened then. It seems it's sanctions week against Russia, and I was amazed to see, as part of his speech, Boris Johnson today finished up by saying the UK will push Russia out of the global economy. Well, I don't know how many people are supposed to believe that around the world, whether the UK or even the US, with the UK, have got the ability to push Russia out of the global economy. I mean, these sorts of threats have been around for many years, and the actual fact of the matter is that the British economy and the American economy are falling apart at the seams, and the real economy in the world are the more stable countries such as China and Russia. These are the real economic powerhouses of the planet. And this is really just a message trying to encourage his own supporters and the Americans. And it's bluster, basically. So there's no way that the British are ever going to push Russia out of the global economy, no more than they can push China out of the global economy. But this is really all they can do.
Well, Russia's military operation in Ukraine has entered its second day, and early on Friday, there were some loud explosions heard in Kiev and across Ukraine, but now we are receiving some news that states some other loud explosions have been heard in central Kiev. Obviously, we keep a close eye on the developments with regards to the military operation that Russia is carrying out in Ukraine, and we will keep you informed of the latest developments as soon as we get them. But for now, with the conflict raging between Russia and Ukraine, the West has been quick to levy sanctions and other penalties on Moscow, but eyebrows have been raised after Britain's political establishment publicly targeted Russia's flagship media outlet in the country. There are now concerns over whether the industry regulator will follow existing media law or bow to political pressure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has slammed NATO's eastward expansion, describing the approach as provocative. Raisi says NATO expansion is a serious threat to stability and security of independent countries in different regions. The Iranian president expressed hope that what is happening at the moment would end to favor the nations in the region. He made the comments in a telephone conversation with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. For his part, Putin said the current situation is a legitimate response to decades of breaches of security treaties by the West and its efforts to undermine his country's security. A powerful earthquake hits Indonesia's largest island, Sumatra. So far, two people have been confirmed dead. 20 others are injured. Some buildings, including a government office, have been damaged. The quake was followed by over a dozen aftershocks and caused tremors in neighboring Singapore and Malaysia. Earthquakes frequently shake Indonesia as the country is placed in a seismically active zone. In 2009, about 1,000 people were killed by a powerful quake there. A jury in the U.S. state of Minnesota says three former police officers involved in the 2020 killing of black man George Floyd are found guilty of violating his civil rights.
Today, former officers Tao, King, and Lane stand convicted by a jury of their peers for willfully violating Mr. Floyd's civil rights, the same rights guaranteed to all of us by the United States Constitution. These officers had a moral responsibility, a legal obligation, and a duty to intervene. And by failing to do so, they committed a crime.
Based on U.S. legislation, all law enforcement officers must provide medical aid to those in their custody. Now in Floyd's case, the three former cops are convicted of showing deliberate indifference to his medical needs. Two were also convicted of failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force against the African-American man. The trio will now remain free on bail pending their sentencing hearing. But a new conviction can affect the severity of their sentence. That has raised hopes for serving justice.
How y'all doing? I'm Philonis Floyd, brother of George Floyd. I have my nephew with me, Brandon Williams, who George raised like a son. Today is a good day for us. That this is the first time that I ever seen something like this did. Four white officers were convicted of killing an African-American man.
The fourth former officer involved in Floyd's killing was Derek Chauvin. Last year, he was convicted of murder and is now serving 22 years in prison. Chauvin knelt on handcuffed Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes before he died. The incident happened in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. It sparked months of protests, both inside and outside the U.S., against police brutality and raised calls for justice for the black people. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight. In the United States, a jury on Tuesday, 22nd of February, found the three white Georgia men who murdered Ahmed Arbery guilty of federal hate crime, determining that they were motivated by racism when they chased the 25-year-old black man through their neighborhood. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Tariro Mezezewa, Audra Birch, and Richard Fawcett. The piece is titled, Three Men Are Found Guilty of Hate Crimes in Arbery Killing. A jury on Tuesday, 22nd of February, found the three white Georgia men who murdered Ahmed Arbery guilty of a federal hate crime, determining that they were motivated by racism when they chased a 25-year-old black man through their neighborhood. The case was one of the most high-profile hate crime trials in years and came after a rash of acts of violence against African Americans, including Ahmed Arbery and George Floyd, led to protests and soul-searching around the nation. it was seen as a victory for the Justice Department, which has pledged to make such cases a priority. While legal analysis says the hate crimes are especially difficult to prove, federal prosecutors in Georgia, in the Georgia trial, presented voluminous evidence of the defendants' racist beliefs and crude language, leaving some jurors visibly shaken. It took them roughly 4 hours to reach a verdict. When it was read out, aloud in court, some jurors wept. National civil rights leaders hailed the conviction as a victory for racial justice in America. As the nation continues to grapple with racially motivated violence by police and vigilantes who shroud themselves in self-appointed authority, the jury sent a powerful message. We see you for what you are, and we will not tolerate your deadly campaign of intimidation, said Mark Morial, chief executive of the National Urban League. This verdict draws a clear line in the sand, he said. Ahmed Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper-Jones, said she never doubted that the jury would find the defendants guilty, but her satisfaction was tempered with grief. As a mother, I will never heal, she said. They gave us a small sense of victory, but we will never get victory because Ahmed is dead. In addition to the hate crime convictions, the jury also found the three men, Travis McMichael, 36-year-old, his father, Gregory McMichael, a 66-year-old, and their neighbour, William Bryan, a 52-year-old, guilty of attempting kidnapping, and found the McMichaels guilty of one count each of brandishing or discharging a firearm during a violent crime. The men now face up to life imprisonment for the federal crimes, on top of the life sentences they received in state court this year after being convicted of Ahmed Arbery's murder, with only William Bryan eligible for parole. The federal convictions ensure that the defendants will receive significant prison time even if their state convictions are overturned or their sentences reduced on appeal. Most cases that local prosecutors and others ask the Justice Department to pursue do not end up this way. The department tends to be careful in selecting such cases, pursuing 17% of the hate crime incidents it was presented between 2005 and 2019. When the department does decide to prosecute, the cases usually end with defendants pleading guilty. In this case, prosecutors had initially reached plea agreements with two of the defendants, Gregory and Travis McMichael, that would have sent them to federal prison for 30 years. But Ahmed Arbery's family protested the deals, in part because they would have allowed the men to serve their time in federal prison, viewed by some as less dangerous, rather than state prison. Judge Lisa Godby Wood ultimately rejected the agreements, allowing the trial to go ahead. She has not yet sentenced the men in the trial that ended on Tuesday, and it was uncertain whether they would start serving their time in a state prison for the murder or in a federal prison for the hate crimes. As a number of recent cases of violent crimes against African Americans have worked their way through the legal system, the Georgia case stood out for forcing a blunt examination of racism in the courtroom. On 23rd of February 2020, the three men used a pair of trucks to chase Ahmed Arbery, who was running through their neighborhood, until the younger, Mr. McMichael, shot him 3 times at close range with a 12-gauge shotgun. Over a week of testimony, federal jurors were exposed to ugly expressions of bigotry by the three white men, and then asked to decide whether those attitudes meant that they had gone after Ahmed Arbery because of his race and colour. Lawyers for the three defendants argued that the men had not been motivated by racial animus, but rather because Mr. Arbery seemed to seemed to them like a potential crime suspect. Gregory McMichael's lawyer, A.J. Balbo, told the jury that Mr. McMichael had not been out to hunt down a black person on that day, but rather to go after Mr. Arbery specifically after a police officer showed him security camera images of Mr. Arbery entering a nearby house that was under construction. Mr. Arbery had entered the house numerous times in the weeks before the shooting, including the moments before the chase began, though there is no evidence he stole or disturbed the property inside. 12 days before the shooting, Travis McMichael had also seen Mr. Arbery outside of the house and had called 911, claiming he saw Mr. Arbery reach towards his waistband, a gesture, Mr. McMichael said, that made it seem like he could have been reaching for a gun. Prosecuting hate crime cases is considered difficult because the government must prove not only that defendants harbour racist views, but that their crimes were specifically motivated by bigotry. In this case, evidence of the defendants' racism proved to be both voluminous and harsh, including numerous uses of racist epithets and racial insults. The government's case, with its video of Mr. Arbery grasping for his final breaths on the pavement and testimony that the defendants did not render aid to him, seemed to take an emotional toll on jurors, some of whom could be seen crying. Last week, one of the jurors asked court officials if counselling was available. At the end of the day, the evidence in this case will prove if Ahmed Arbery had been white, he would have gone for a jog, checked out a house under construction, and been home in time for Sunday supper, Bobby Bernstein, a Justice Department lawyer, told the jury. Instead, he went out for a jog and he ended up running for his life. Instead, he ended up bleeding to death, alone and scared, in the middle of the street. After the verdict, one defense lawyer declined to comment and a second could not be reached. Pete Theodosian, lawyer for Mr. William Bryan, said he had been optimistic about his client's chances. "We'll have to respect the decision of the jury and move on from here," he said. The verdict was an important victory for the Justice Department. Attorney General Merrick Garland said at a news conference that today's verdict makes clear that the Justice Department will continue to use every resource at its disposal to confront unlawful acts of hate and to hold accountable those who perpetrate them. The death of Ahmed Arbery was met with revulsion from both conservative and liberal lawmakers in Georgia. It prompted state legislators to significantly weaken a citizen's arrest law that one local prosecutor cited soon after the shooting to argue that the three men should not be arrested. It also prompted them to pass a state hate crime law. This month, the legislature also passed a resolution declaring Wednesday, the second anniversary of the killing, Ahmed Arbery Day. Memorial events are planned in several cities in Georgia. As the verdicts were read out in court on Tuesday morning, Mr. Arbery's parents and other family members lowered their heads, some praying. "Thank God," said Marcus Arbery Sr., Ahmed Arbery's father. The only black man on the jury, who also served as the foreman, wiped tears from his face as the verdict for each charge was read. The woman seated beside him also cried throughout Tuesday's proceedings. "Ahmed Arbery will continue to rest in peace," said Wanda Cooper Jones, Mr. Arbery's mother, "but he will now begin to rest in power."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
While the current wave of resistance in the occupied West Bank is renewing itself through continuous resistance operations against the Zionist entity and its illegal colonial settlers, the Negev Desert over the past week has joined the series of surprises. After a long period of silence, during which the occupation thought that it could simply force the Palestinian residents to evacuate their villages, the recent uprising in the Negev came along to revive the Israeli nightmare of the Saif al-Quds. A threat to the state. The discussion here is not about Israel's paranoia with Iran's nuclear project nor Hezbollah's precise missiles. Rather, what Israel views as direct threat from the people of the Palestinian desert to its actual existence as an apartheid entity. After all, Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Zionist entity, was frank when he said, "If we do not stand firm in the desert, Tel Aviv will fall." This is a quotation that the Karen Kayameth Le'Israel Jewish National Fund used as its slogan decades ago for afforestation of the Negev Desert, addressing its projects entitled Achieving Ben-Gurion's Vision, while of course linking their plans to a number of God's promises exclusively to them. The Zionist occupation referred to the Palestinians of the Negev as the Bedouin problem. Finding a solution for this problem has been since 2005 the responsibility of the Israeli National Security Council, which explicitly means that in the eyes of the occupation, these native Palestinians constitute a demographic and existential danger and an explosive substance that contains violent energy for confrontation. The Knesset even approved in 2005 the Public Lands Law, which stipulates the eviction of public lands from any people, movable property, animals, or every building based on it and everything related to it permanently. For years, this law was used as a pretext to displace Palestinians from the Negev, whether by demolishing their homes, spraying their crops and livestock with toxic chemicals, or bulldozing their crops and planting trees unfamiliar to desert environment as an alternative, as well as imposing outrageous fines on Palestinians who dare enter their own land. The events underway in the Negev are but an episode of the series of devastation that the Palestinians experience there on a daily basis. Under the protection of the Zionist police and escorted by the bulldozers, members of the Jewish National Fund storm what they refer to as the unrecognized villages, raise the lands without any prior warning in preparation for fencing them and then confiscating them for the benefit of the illegal Zionist settlement project. This has been going on for such a long time that the native Palestinians realized they had no choice but to take matters into their own hands and reclaim their rights, because the law in that forest was never on their side. After all, what was taken by force can only be restored by force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Although there are local reasons for the recent ignition of the Israeli campaign on the Negev, what this region is witnessing today is not far from the historical context established by David Ben-Gurion, since he declared that if Israel does not preserve the desert, then Tel Aviv will fall. A slogan regularly repeated by the Jewish National Fund, which had a remarkable role in establishing the Zionist entity and is working to implement this slogan in Negev with temporary settlement plans. Now, plans that are erected under the pretext of the blooming of the desert project as a cover for the displacement of native Palestinians. On the other hand, these Palestinians insist on clinging to their rights, railing with every possible tool the daily epic struggle and steadfastness. To discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Sarah Wilkinson, a human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine from a very long time. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah, to discuss the issue of the Negev. Now, the Israeli establishment with its various arms is masterful in clamping down on the people of the occupied Negev as far as 1948 and attempting to steal their land. But the past week, Zionists were actually surprised with the massive popular upheaval in the areas of Arab al-Atrash and Sa'wa, in scenes that brought back to the memory of the Intifada of the Palestinian people of 48. We're talking about the occupied territories inside of Palestine, especially during last May in the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds. How do you assess such a popular resistance by the 1948 Arabs?
I think recently what we've seen is some very, very coordinated campaigns which have mobilized people not just in Palestine but also internationally. The Save Sheikh Jarrah campaign, Save Silwan, Save Beta, they've all become quite well known, popularized. And so I think that, you know, the resistance against the ethnic cleansing, which is an ethnic cleansing of the Nakab, on a massive scale, some of the groundwork had already been laid. And so the Palestinians have become much more like one society, one force against Israeli occupation, which is, and less fragmented, which is something that we've probably not seen for quite a long time. So the movement has been growing for many years. But I think the Save Sheikh Jarrah movement, with activists like Mohammed Al-Kurd and Munir Al-Kurd, that has popularized it. And it has made people aware of it all across the world. And it's laid the groundwork for such resistance, I think.
Well, Sarah, it seems that activists in the occupied Negev believe that the aim of this theft is to actually prevent the expansion of the natural expansion, by the way, of the Palestinian villages, and to impose restrictions on their people to force them to migrate again to other areas in occupied Palestine, knowing that the Israeli entity, since after the 1948 Nakba, had adopted the method of afforestation in the abandoned villages to practically just to obliterate Palestinian monuments, Palestinian history from those villages. We see a lot of images and photos of old houses eaten up by Mother Nature because of this attempted afforestation by the Zionist entity. So it's a matter of actual survival for these Palestinians versus an illegal expansion of the Zionist settlement in Negev. In the case Israel decides to ups the ante against the Bedouins, Sarah, will there be coordinated resistance similar to what we saw last May?
Well, this is it. Whether the Palestinians can maintain or sustain this amount of resistance, this is a huge area we're talking about. It's like 3.3 million acres, if I'm right. I don't know what that is in dunams, but it's a massive area. So, and the attempt from the Zionists to take over the Nakab region, that's been going on for decades, probably since 1948. So it's been renewed. With the JNF funding, renewed funding, actually experimental weaponry as well is being used against them. So it's been renewed under the guise of this forestation, urbanization, the new Tel Aviv city, if you like, that's going to be built over the top of these ethnically cleansed Bedouin villages, of which 70 villages, I think, are under threat, or around 70 villages. So this plan has been going on for decades, but what the Israelis have done is renewed it under the pretext of forestation. Well, we're quite aware that, during 1948, over 500 villages were ethnically cleansed. They were wiped off the map, and forestation was one of the ways that they buried these ethnically cleansed villages with non-indigenous trees to make the new settlers more welcome, or, they found the trees more welcoming. Of course, that caused forest fires, which in turn, I think the sinister part of the plot was probably the Israelis don't mind about the forest fires because it finished off the villages and prevents them from returning home. So this plan has been going on for a long time, but it's been revised to look like something that politicians are more likely to want to invest in. It's like a greenwashing But we must never forget this is a massive ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. And the Israelis aren't just going to turn around because there is some resistance. What it will do is will continue an onslaught, an invasion of the Nakab until it gets what it wants. And yes, the idea is to force 70 or 90,000 Bedouin into small areas near the nuclear reactor, the Dimona reactor, where the ground is toxic.
Because so they want to move the people, they want to move the native Palestinians closer to Dimona?
Yeah, I think there's three areas. I think Beersheba is one. I forget one, but the other one is Dimona. But we know that that 55-year-old nuclear reactor has been leaking. The Israelis have been handing out. They've actually been distributing anti-radiation pills to the Israelis who live and work there. So they know the area isn't safe. So you move 70 communities into these 27,000 acres, bearing in mind 3.3 million acres is where they come from, into a tiny 27,000 acre region that is not safe for subsistence farming. What you're doing is not just ethnically cleansing them by making them migrate, you're actually shortening their life expectancy. So actually it's a double ethnic cleansing. I think it's quite sinister to be moving subsistence farmers that work on the land, that have sheep, livestock, cattle, into areas that are not safe to farm in.
Well, that definitely will open up a lot of doors to the actual reason that would push Tel Aviv to do this to the Palestinians, who already know as an occupation this is something that they have been doing for the past century, but specifically with the Bedouin crisis, moving them closer to such a very high risky area, which kind of seems like they're using them as human shields to protect, yes, basically whatever they are hiding in that area. But it's been a pleasure having, yes, you on, Sarah Wilkinson, human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine. I'm sorry that we are out of time, but I promise that we will have you more to talk about this. Sadly, we need to talk more about this as much as we can. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian-Syrian new economic ties.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Syrian President Bashar Assad and Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi discussed last week bilateral relations, especially at the economic level. Now, President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that achieve the common strategic benefit of Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. The joint discussions also dealt with ways to expand bilateral work in the public and private sectors and encourage joint investments with the aim of giving a new drive to trade and economic ties. For his part, Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian population in the face of the horrific war, the terrorist war that they have been facing, and Iran's keenness to expand cooperation between the two countries in all fields that serve the interests of the two friendly peoples. Iran and Syria to expand trade ties in this following report.
Iranian Minister of Transport and Urban Development Rostam Ghazemi arrived in Syria last week, heading a high-level economic and political delegation to discuss ways to develop economic cooperation between the two countries. Upon his arrival at Damascus Airport, where he was received by Syrian Economy Minister Mohammad Samer al-Khalil and Iranian Ambassador to Syria Mahdi Subhani, Minister Ghazemi stressed the determination of Tehran and Damascus to achieve real economic and trade partnership. For his part, the Syrian Minister of Economy affirmed that his country seeks comprehensive cooperation with Iran, hoping the meeting will lead to good consensus in order to reach full economic and trade partnership between the two countries. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Iranian Minister of Transportation Rostam Ghazemi discussed bilateral economic relations. President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that would achieve the common strategic benefit for Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian people in the face of the war against terrorism and American imperialism. Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates Faisal Maqdad and Iranian Minister Qasimi also met and discussed issues of common interest between the two countries, stressing the need to upgrade economic relations between them to keep pace with the level of development of joint political relations. Iran and Syria had also signed 4 documents to boost cooperation in the fields of trade and industry during a visit of an Iranian delegation headed by the country's industry minister to Damascus last month. The documents were inked at the end of the two countries' joint economic and industrial committee meetings, which were held in the Syrian capital, Damascus. However, last week's important bilateral economic talks came simultaneously as Syria officially joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. unilateral punitive measures. Damascus's participation was initiated during a ceremony last Tuesday through the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding by Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority Chair Fadil Khalil and Chinese Ambassador to Syria Feng Biao. The initiative gets its name from the ancient Silk Road that once ran through Asia, with West Asia serving as a crossroads to Africa and Europe. The Iranian and Chinese trade pact signed last week with Syria will act as defining goals and guides to all three countries' projects, which will for sure deepen the working cooperation between them and strengthen the harmonization between Iran, Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative and the policies of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, while also strengthening Iranian and Chinese participation in the economic reconstruction of Syria. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Sara Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Sara. Now, an Iranian delegation headed by Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi visited the Syrian capital last week and met with Syrian President Bashar Assad and a number of government ministers and discussed with them the various commercial, industrial, and banking sectors. How do you assess the importance of such economic ties between Iran and Syria at such a difficult time?
Well, let me start by saying that Iran did not only stand by Syria politically and militarily, but also stood by Syria economically over the last decade. This was manifested in two ways. The first is through the delivery of various commodities, oil derivatives, production requirements, and many other essentials to Syria. The second relates to the renewed prospects that were evident in the joint free trade zone between the two countries and the credit line, which was worth nearly $2 billion. Unfortunately, however, the level of economic relations has not yet reached the level of political and military relations between both states. In this context, we saw Minister Qasemi's vital visit to Damascus, where a number of agreements and understandings were signed. What is new in Minister Qasemi's visit to Damascus, other than Qasemi's status as head of the Syrian-Iranian Joint Economic Committee, but also his status as Minister of Transportation and Urban Development in Iran? This is a new indication of the stage that the two countries will enter together to mark the start of the reconstruction phase in Syria after more than a decade of war. Let me pass on to you this piece of information that has not yet been announced. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi will be visiting Damascus in less than a month. Of course, what will be evaluated in this upcoming visit is the results of Minister Qasemi's visit and also to raise the level of economic relations between the two countries.
That sounds very, very interesting, Ms. Sarah. Well, Minister Qasemi, who heads, just as you said, the Iranian side of the Iranian-Syrian Joint Economic Committee, indicated in a statement after the conclusion of his working visit to Syria that a consensus was reached to work on establishing, quote, a joint bank and opening branches of existing local banks in both countries, in addition to joint free trade zones in both countries. Now, this is a
crystal clear challenge to the U.S.'s illegal Caesar's Law that was meant to actually besiege Syria financially. How do you think the Americans will react to such a new financial deal between Syria and Iran?
Let me just make 2 points clear. The idea of the Syrian-Iranian joint bank is not a new idea, but it was established in 2009 or 2010. That is actually obtained a license to operate in Syria under the name of Bank of Hope. But kickstarting that bank was not successful at the time for various reasons, but what matters today is that it has been revived. This idea is to reactivate this bank again. You asked me about the American reaction to these economic ties. Certainly the United States will not be satisfied or pleased with these relations. But regardless of this, Iran has always succeeded in evading illegal American sanctions. Iran succeeded in delivering all derivatives to Syria and broke the equation of unilateral punitive measures by delivering aid to Venezuela and to Lebanon as well. We even witnessed the war that almost erupted in the Arabian Sea after the United States of America tried to block one of the ships transporting Iranian oil derivatives. And you know very well that today there are negotiations underway in Vienna. If the results of these talks are positive, it is a good thing. And if not, I think that there are escalatory steps that Iran will take to break the siege, and the financial and banking sector is not immune to these steps. I'm referring here specifically to the Syrian-Iranian joint bank, which will be activated soon.
Well, Ms. Sarah, Minister Kazemi said something very interesting during his visit concerning transportation in various sectors being one of the most important requirements for both countries' economic development. So the road the U.S. waged war against Syria to prevent from opening between regional countries, especially Iran, Iraq, and Syria, will officially be opened soon. Some might say Syria paid a heavy price for this road. Do you agree?
Of course, Syria paid a heavy price for this road and this war in general. Syria, as you may know, was a strong country in West Asia. It has moved from being a country that is self-sufficient and food-sufficient with zero foreign debts to a country that, unfortunately, is experiencing suffocating economic and social crises. But for now, what is most important is that the blood of the martyrs should not be wasted, the blood of the martyrs who fell in this war. An important issue you touch upon is construction and infrastructure project that will link the three countries, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, together. This project will bring about very important economic and political results for all three states and will provide jobs for many citizens. This project will not only transport goods between the three countries, but will also transport citizens. For instance, goods used to take 2 months to reach from Iran to Syria. Today, thanks to this project, if it is successfully implemented, goods will only take a few days to reach Syria. The project's starting point will be the Iranian-Iraqi border. It will stretch to reach Al-Qa'im, then to Al-Bukamal, and then to Homs, and to end off at two destinations, the Syrian capital Damascus and Latakia on the Syrian coast. Certainly, this project will have very important economic and political results. Also, this project will be linked to other networks in Central Asia, and in turn, these networks will be linked to other networks in Russia and China.
Well, Ms. Sarah, exactly what you said is very important because officially Syria has joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. sanctions, which I don't like to call sanctions. They are unilateral punitive measures by the United States of America against Syria in hopes of securing a lifeline for lucrative investment in a country that is still ravaged by more than a decade of global war against it. Now, Damascus participation happened during the same week which it's actually signed the new deals with Iran. It did the signatory with the Chinese ambassador in Syria, Mr. Feng Biao, opening up to Iran and to China in the same week. Look, I can hear Americans screaming because of this, but how do you think this step will benefit Syria in the upcoming future?
Of course, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt, One Road Initiative, is the largest initiative of the century. And since the planning of this initiative, Syria was destined to be an essential component of it, but the war effectively delayed its accession to this initiative. You also remember that the Chinese foreign minister was in Damascus in the seventh month of the last year, and he signed that at that time this agreement. to return this year to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority and the Chinese side, authorizing Syria's entry into this initiative, which includes several economic and social aspects like health, education, and most important of all is the aspect of reconstruction. We may not see its results tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but we will certainly see them soon. You know, the direction of the Syrian government today is to head east. Unfortunately, we have previously experienced failed projects with the European Union, which used our economy to blackmail us in politics and impose unjust unilateral sanctions. This is a fundamental reason for what we Syrians are experiencing today from several stifling living and economic crises. Meanwhile, China has proved in the past 10 years that it is an economic superpower that has been rising tremendously and has also proven that it is a trustworthy partner. I stress here on the word partner because it has established a new concept in international relations, which is partnership between great powers and other countries instead of the concept of hegemony.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Sarah Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent economic ties between Iran, Syria, and China, for that matter. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Bye-bye.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration released its first global posture review with the continuation of a Cold War stance towards China and Russia. We're prepared for you an article written by Jeremy Scahill. The piece is titled Biden to Pentagon, Keep the War Machine Running. The article has been taken from the Intercept website.